Sejn xandru it-tieni parti tal-lecture li ingħatat minn Father Daniel Madigan bit-tema Is Dialogue with Islam Possible in Europe? Nisimgħu it-tieni parti ta' din il-lecture.
Although we refer to our dialogue very often as interreligious dialogue, religion often has very little to do with it. And I wouldn't recommend that that's the first topic that you talk about, because I really don't think that that's the issue in many cases. If we look at around the world, in this world that so preoccupies us, rightly preoccupies us, and we examine all the conflicts which are defined as interreligious conflicts, and we look a little more deeply at them with somewhat more sophistication than you find in kindergarten, then we actually see that what is at issue is not religion at all, but there are elements of ethnicity, elements of economics, elements of post-colonial politics, elements of current the geopolitics of oil. Let's take a couple of examples. What is going on in Indonesia? In Indonesia, we are often told there's great tension between Christians and Muslims, and we take it as kind of self-evident that yes, of course there would be, and that that explains everything. These churches are being burned because they're churches. These people are being attacked because they are Christians, and the Christians who attack the Muslims and even drag them and kill them in the street, they're doing that because those people are Muslims. But if we look a little deeper, we see when things started to deteriorate in Indonesia, it was the time of the deterioration of the economic situation, the Asian economic crisis in the 1990s, when the bottom fell out of several of the Asian economies. Suddenly, things start to change. The relations between different groups change. And why? Which were the first Christian shops to be burnt, attacked? Which were the first churches to be attacked? The churches of the Chinese Christians. Why the Chinese? Because they're Christian, or because all the Indonesians believe, rightly or wrongly, that the Chinese control 80% of the Indonesian economy? And that, for all Indonesians, is gospel truth. It's been presented in a doctoral dissertation that I marked once, without any, you know, and I asked in the defense, I said, well, where do you get this figure from? Well, everybody knows. And that from a Muslim. And I asked a friend of mine, a Jesuit Indonesian, is this true? He said, well, everybody knows it's true. And what everybody knew about the 80% of control of the Indonesian economy, which had suddenly gone bad, was projected onto the Chinese and onto their most visible presence, which was their shops and their churches. And so the attacks had much more to do with economics and ethnicity and the politics of dictatorship under Suharto. Suharto was much supported by the Chinese, the wealthy Chinese. It had much more to do with that than it did with the Trinity or Christology or anything to do with religion. If we look at other parts of Indonesia, we find that you have a situation where the central government, which Indonesia is, if you like, the Javanese Empire. it's not just one country. It's a Java is the heart of Indonesia, and the Javanese transplant Javanese populations all throughout these islands in order to develop the economy, in order to strengthen the ties between these different islands. So when the economy goes bad, the Javanese community that has been transplanted there as a kind of economic force suddenly becomes a threat. They are the ones who are economically secure, and the local people are no longer secure. And the local people are of a different ethnic group and a different language, and in many places of a different religion. And so the Javanese are attacked. Is it Christians attacking Muslims because they're Muslims? Or is it Dayaks attacking Javanese because they're Javanese? We too easily put a religious label on these conflicts. And so when we come to dialogue, it's probably better to have various other elements on our list and put religion about number 5 or 6, I think. I hate to do it because I love to talk about religion, but it's just, that's the way it's got to be. If we are ever going to understand what is really going on, then we cannot keep this absurd notion that people are killing one another over their theology. They're killing one another over power and ethnicity and oil and control and struggles for power in post-colonial societies. I could go on with examples from Nigeria and other places, but it's the same wherever you go. If you look beneath the surface of the religious labels, you will find, very often you will find oil. That's crucial in many places, including Indonesia. And you will very often find post-colonialism, which is another element rather more complex and a bit difficult to go into now. Our dialogue, if we're going to do it here in Europe, has to take account of the fact of the asymmetry of the situation. It may seem to many Europeans that the enormous power of Islam has sort of flooded in here and we are about to be overcome. But in fact, the numbers are relatively small, and the power relationships are absolutely skewed. By far, the vast majority of Muslims in the world and also in Europe is poor. The vast majority of Muslims that we have to deal with in Europe are people who are either here as refugees or they are here as immigrants who are seeking to escape situations of underdevelopment, or they are people who have been brought in to do our work for us. Many countries in Europe have imported laborers deliberately by policy, settled them in their countries to do the dirty work or to expand the economy, and it still happens. So we are not in equal positions. It's not a matter of expecting that all the cultured people of Europe are going to find interlocutors with whom they can easily speak one-to-one on the same level of intellectual and cultural development. Of course, there are Muslims in Europe who are university professors, who are here for several generations. You have a well-known Muslim at the University of Florence who teaches Dante, if you can believe it, an Egyptian, teaching Dante in Florence. A very cultured man, and a man well able to hold his own in a conversation. But by and large, we have to recognize the power disparity in our European dialogue. And so we are not just dealing with people always like ourselves, though we may be. We have to also recognize that people develop, people grow, that there is it's no longer just the first generation of immigrant workers. There are people in Europe, Muslims in Europe, who have grown up here, who have citizenship, who are as cultured as any one of us, who are as educated and who have benefited from our universities as much as any one of us. This element of dissymmetry, or asymmetry, I should perhaps say, is very important, because what tends to happen, and I find it a very worrying trend, and you hear it too often, is a kind of hostage-taking. I call it, to give it a name. I think it's fair to call it that. Let me give you an example. A group of Moroccan laborers somewhere, legal immigrants imported for the work they can do for us, used for their economic capacity, wants to have a mosque. They want to get permission from the municipality to build their mosque. And someone says, well, hang on, Christians in Saudi Arabia can't have a church, why should we let you have a mosque? When the Saudi royal family gives permission to the Christians in Riyadh to have a church, then you will get your mosque. That is hostage taking. That is making a group of poor immigrants who have nothing to do with the Saudi royal family, it is using them in some way to, as though they can ring up the Saudi royal family and say, would you just give permission for a church and then we can have our mosque? They can't do it. And we, all our making an example of them is a kind of hostage taking. We have the power. We can do it. We can take hostages. We can deny people their rights in Europe for as long as we like, in the hope of getting those other governments to act in the way we would like them to do. But let's call it for what it is. It is an abuse of power. The dialogue that we want to have in Europe has to be a dialogue that is true to, if it's true that Europe has Christian roots, though it doesn't appear in the Constitution, it has to be true to our Christian values, if it's a Christian-Muslim dialogue, and it has to be true to our European values. I speak as a second-hand European. Australians got lots of things from Europe, including our taste. The first time I ever came to Europe, I looked around and I felt like I was coming home, though I'd never been here before, because everything about us says, that stone building is beautiful. We don't have anything like it, but we've been educated. That's our culture. Our values, the values we pride ourselves on as Europeans, whether genuine ones or second-hand ones like myself, must be at the basis of our dialogue. So much of, and Father Paul spoke of this, the idea that our European heritage is under threat from this extraneous group coming in, or that our Maltese Catholicism, our Maltese Catholic identity, or our European Christian identity is under threat. Yes, it is under threat. But I don't think it's always under threat simply from the fact that there are people of other religions coming here. I think it is under threat in another way altogether. We are in danger of betraying the very thing we are trying to save. If we try, in Italy, even cardinals talk this way, we are trying to save the Catholic identity of Italy, so in order to do that, we must send back these poor people who have fled here seeking political asylum, because they're the wrong religion. We have to turn away the poor, we have to turn away the refugees, in order to protect our Christian identity. He who seeks to save his life will lose it. If we try to protect our identity by being un-Christian, then we've killed the very thing that we're trying to save. And the same thing applies to Europe, our European values, whether secular or slightly more religiously tinted. If we discriminate against people on the basis simply of their religion, if we say, you are Muslim, therefore you cannot immigrate here. We are giving preference to Catholic Filipinos or Catholics from South America. If we do that, we have betrayed the very secular tradition which Europe prides itself on in not discriminating against people simply on the basis of their religion, but taking them as human beings who have rights and duties. So the values that we are seeking to protect are the very values that have to be part of this dialogue. We dialogue because it's part of who we are. Europe is not Europe if it is not dialogical. Catholicism is not Catholicism if it is not dialogical. That's official. That's the official policy. We can't say we're trying to save our Catholicism by refusing to dialogue. It's just not on. So if it is a Christian dialogue with believers of other traditions, especially with Muslims, what kind of dialogue does it have to be? Above all, it has to be a loving dialogue. You can't say you're a Christian unless you are prepared to treat another person lovingly. This, at least the bare minimum of this, I think, is expressed at the beginning of St. Ignatius' Spiritual Exercises in what he calls the presupposition. Now, he was functioning in a situation where everyone was suspicious of everybody else, and they were trying to catch one another out in doctrinal errors, and he himself three times ended up in the Inquisition's jails because people said, he's an Illuminist, he's one of these. And he begins his exercises by saying, the presupposition is that every decent Christian takes the words of the person who is speaking to him or her and gives them the most positive interpretation possible, tries to understand them in the best possible way. If trying to understand them in the best possible way, it still seems that this person is somehow mistaken, then I do whatever I can charitably to enter into dialogue with this person and convince this person of his or her error. But I don't immediately condemn. So the presupposition of the exercises, I think, is a good presupposition for any dialogue, to take in the best possible way what the other person says. If it seems harsh, if it seems unfamiliar, if it seems off the wall, it may be that it's a very strange thing that's been said, but I have to make the effort. It's a positive effort to understand the other person's word in the most positive way possible. That's a kind of hospitality, if you like. It's a kind of way of saying, okay, you know, I'm letting you into my mental space. I am welcoming you into this discussion. And hospitality, I think, I have come to believe, is the highest Christian value. It's the most concrete expression. If you think of what is the central action of Christian worship, it is at the table, the Last Supper. It is the hospitality of Jesus on the night before he died. That is the key to who we are. And people who study the early history of the Christian movement in the Roman Empire have come to realize that it was precisely Christian hospitality which made that movement grow. It was the Christian community's hospitality in those awful places that were the cities of the Roman Empire, in which there were incredible movements of people, people from the provinces, people enslaved, people recently freed. These cities were not the beautiful forums and things that we see in Rome. These cities were places of enormous suffering and enormous uprootedness. And it was precisely the Christian community's hospitality, their preparedness to welcome the stranger, their preparedness to be of service to these moving masses of people who had no one, that made the greatest impact in the growth of that movement. Now, I think we have in Europe today precisely that same opportunity and precisely that same vocation. If we want to pride ourselves on being a Christian Europe, and it doesn't matter to me, I'm not European, but it doesn't matter to me in the slightest that those words didn't find their way into the Constitution, because you don't make yourself Christian by sticking in a line or two for Silvio Berlusconi to sign. You make yourself Christian by being Christian, by showing yourself Christian. If Europe has Christian roots, and I believe it does, it will show. Not in the Constitution, but in the hands and the feet of the Christians who live here. So a hospitable dialogue, a dialogue that welcomes the stranger, a dialogue that welcomes the one who cannot pay back, who cannot reciprocate, who doesn't have perhaps the intellectual or the cultural or the linguistic tools required to be an equal and to give back as good as he or she is given. That is a truly Christian dialogue. A dialogue concretely hospitable, not the kind of hostility that we see so often advocated and far too often practiced. It must be a sustained dialogue. If we think that in the space of an hour or two or an afternoon that we are really going to enter into dialogue, serious dialogue with another person, then we've got another think coming. We know it from our own experience of any relationship. It requires time. It requires great effort to understand over a long period of time. It requires learning language in more ways than one, not just learning some Arabic or learning some Kurdish, or though that can help enormously, but taking the time and the effort to learn how the other person thinks. What is their vocabulary to express their faith? What is their cultural vocabulary? To learn their language, their body language, to learn their name. To learn their name. No dialogue can be anonymous. And that is one of the great dangers of our current European discourse about dialogue, is we're talking about them. And the only one of them that has a name, pretty much, is Osama bin Laden. But there are 1.3 billion names among the world's Muslims, and there are names of Muslims even in this room, and there are names of Muslims in this city, and each one of them, as each one of us has a name, our dialogue will be a dialogue of people together who know one another's name, and who can, when, as things develop, think of themselves as not me and her, but us. That ultimately is our goal, to live, to think in the first person plural. We, us, our. We are in Europe, this is our Europe. Our Europe is in our world, and we have to do something about it. Thank you.
Għadkom kem smajtu it-tini parti tal-lecture li inatat minn Father Daniel Madigan bit-tema Is Dialogue with Islam Possible in Europe? L-aħħar parti tix-xandar il-ġimgħa d-dieħla.